So it's a great pleasure to me to welcome Carolyn from the Carnegie Mellon University as lecturer in our today's webinar. Carolyn's research, I have to read aloud, so I prepared the text, so if you wonder why I look always aside, that's Carolyn's research focuses on better understanding of the social and pragmatic nature of conversations, and using this understanding to build computational systems that can improve the efficiency of conversations between people and between people and computers. So her research contributed substantially to automated analysis of collaborative learning processes and dynamic support of collaborative learning, so that we have conversational agents that can be used to support collaborative learning, for example, in a context-sensitive way. And Carolyn is not only a great researcher, she published also quite a lot of her work and influences our work with that papers. She published over 150 peer-reviewed papers in different scientific fields. So she's not only a great author, she also is associate editor of the International Journal of Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning and the IEEE Transactions on Learning Technologies. So it will be a great time to listen to her. I experienced several of her talks and I enjoyed all of them, so be really happy to be here. And maybe Carolyn would like to say some words about her before her talk, before she starts. Great to have you here, Carolyn. It's your floor is yours.
Hi, I'm so happy to have a chance to talk to you all. I've been so excited that Frank started this Naples effort. I think it's extremely valuable for the community, and I'm glad to be able to participate in some way. Since I don't know many of you, I'm not entirely sure what kind of background you are coming with. And I want to make sure that I'm not either talking about things that are too basic or sort of zooming ahead. So I would like to encourage you to stop me if you feel that the presentation is not well targeted to you. You can feel free to type a question into the chat section and I'll see it while I'm here. I hope that you have had a chance now to download the slides, and I will be referring to my slides and particular page numbers within those slides so that you can follow along and see the images. And I have divided the presentation into segments, so then I'll present a little bit and then there will be some discussion. And I have prepared some discussion questions to try to get some interaction going, but you can always feel free to ask your own questions and make your own comments. And in particular, if you've done related work and you disagree with anything I've said, I'm always very happy to hear any kind of disagreements or different perspectives. As we all know, one of the values of collaborative learning is that we have the opportunity to compare our multiple perspectives and come out with a richer understanding. So let's go ahead and get started so we can use our time well. Okay, so I'll be starting the first segment of my talk, which covers some of the actual early work that Karsten was alluding to when he gave his introduction to me. And in fact, my work in language processing began really about 25 years ago, but it was only about 8 years ago when I started to work on collaborative learning discourse. And it was really through a collaboration with Frank Fischer and Armin Weinberger and Karsten Stegman that I started to do that work. I'm going to start out on slide number 3, and just to give you at the very highest level, what am I even talking about here? I'm talking about using machine learning technology to be able to apply some structuring and labeling to a collaborative discourse in order to be able to draw inferences about what's going on there, how the processes relate to learning, how experimental manipulations change the way people communicate with one another. And from a very, very simplistic standpoint, the point of applying machine learning technology is to be able to take data that has been hand-labeled, to have the machine learning algorithms find patterns that connect features of the language with those hand labels so that you end up with a model that you can then apply to unlabeled data and get labeled data out. Now, if you move on to slide 4, you can see kind of a graphical representation of the data set that I worked on with Frank's group. And this was a setup that many of you are probably familiar with from their talks, where sets of 3 students would work together on a case analysis. And there would be particular roles assigned to the students. In particular, there was a case analyst and 2 constructive critics. And there was a script that led them through that activity, how they were going to read a case and then apply a theory to it. And they were going to do so through a particular process that would lead first the case analyst to give their analysis and then the constructive critics to come in. And finally, the case analyst would respond. And I believe that there was also sometimes a free form discussion afterward. Regardless of role, people could contribute to that threaded discussion. So you can see here a representation of the threaded discussion, and you can see here also 2 kind of stand-in example messages which have been segmented. And you can see that as part of that segmenting, you can see places where somebody has replied to somebody else's message and has quoted part of their message. And in some conditions, there were also prompts included that were part of the scripting that supported the collaboration. And Frank's group had developed a multidimensional coding scheme for looking at various aspects of the argumentation that would go on during these discussions. And multidimensional coding to be able to make inferences about how various types of script-based support were affecting the discourse. And in our collaboration, Frank's group provided me with a very large corpus of hand-tagged conversations. And my job was, with my group, to try to use machine learning to replicate that hand coding. And we were able to do a reasonable job across many dimensions, achieving almost human levels of accuracy. But what I'm here to tell you today is not to really sell you that machine learning is magic, that it's going to solve all your problems, it's going to do your work for you. Some people wish that that would be the message I would tell. That's not at all what I would tell. What I'd like you to come away from this with is an idea of what it takes from the side of the researcher to make their data set up appropriately so that machine learning will work well. And I'd like to just give a nod over to Jin, if it is indeed Jin Mu, because I think she understands very well how important the representation of the data is for making machine learning work well, for making it work in a generalizable way. And the more you work with it, the more you see the algorithms are not magic at all. It's really what you as the researcher from your insight into the data contribute to how that data is set up that makes it so that machine learning can do its particular work. So now if you go over to slide 5, you'll see that in our initial experiments, which you read about in the paper that was kind of assigned reading for this session, that there were 2 important kinds of features that we added to the representation of the text that allowed us to improve our performance specifically on a dimension called social modes of co-construction, which is a dimension that expresses how the learners are referring to and building on each other's ideas. And we want to see in a collaborative discourse that people are listening to each other, that they're processing what each other is saying, that they're thinking about how their own ideas relate. And we see that represented as part of a process on this particular dimension. But this dimension is tricky to automatically analyze if all you look at is particular segments out of context. You have to see how they fit into the context as a whole. And these 2 features that we added were really simple ways of trying to leverage that idea. And it was really an understanding of what transactivity is, or I call it transactivity, the social modes of co-construction, how by its very nature it's about the function of a particular piece of text in the context that made us realize that without adding in that insight into the feature space, the algorithms would never be able to find the patterns that needed to be found. So the two features that we added, they're very simple. One of them is referring to the depth in a thread that a message appears in, with the idea that since social modes of co-construction relates to how people refer back to previous ideas, then the opportunities for referring back are different depending upon where in the thread a message appears. And in particular, you won't find at the very top of a thread a message that meaningfully connects to prior ideas, because that's an initiating thread. It's a thread that's starting a new direction in the conversation. So those contributions in those initial posts are much more likely to just be externalizations. And then later on, you might have some combination. And the longer a conversation goes, maybe the more likely it is that people will be referring back. So that could be a good predictor. Another one is looking at the similarity between the text in a segment and texts that were contributed by other speakers earlier in the thread. If we, a message that has a good overlap with what has been said before is more likely to be referring back to what is said before. Now, that's not to say that in contributing something that refers back that you necessarily have to repeat words from that previous turn, but it can be a good signal that that kind of reference is going on. And in particular, when we design our feature spaces for machine learning, we want to think about proxies for the real features that we as humans would look for in those texts, because ask a person, but you can think, well, as a human, I want to see what is the, in what sense does this message reflect some understanding and processing of what has come before. And you can ask yourself, well, from a computer's perspective, what would be evidence of that? And word overlap is something that a computer is capable of doing and that may serve as a proxy for seeing those kinds of connections. Now, if we had access to more linguistic information about word classes and relationships between words and semantic relatedness, we might have been able to do an even better job. But this was a very simple way of getting at that proxy. And in fact, we see in the results that it had a very strong, actually surprisingly strong effect. So now I'm going to move on to slide 6. And here we can see a comparison across three different dimensions from Frank Fisher and Armin Weinberger's multidimensional coding scheme. The first set of columns labeled social is the social modes of co-construction, and then we have macro and micro argumentation. And those will just be comparison cases. Now keep in mind that across these three sets of experiments, the data was exactly the same. The human coders were exactly the same. The segments were even exactly the same. The only thing that was different was the set of labels that were assigned to the data. And then the individual columns, the colors, represent sets of features that we use to make the model with. And even the algorithm that we used was the same across all of these bars. The only thing that was different was which kinds of features we included. And the white bar is the simplest feature space, with features that are very easy to extract automatically, either from Tag Helper, which was the original tool that was discussed in that article, or LightSide, which is a more recent instantiation, one that I would like to point you all to, and that you have the opportunity to download and play with yourself. And you replicate these experiments or other experiments that you would like to be able to run. Now you can see that especially on the social modes of co-construction, with this baseline easy feature space, the results were actually very poor. But then the gray lines are, the first gray line is just adding in that thread depth feature. The second gray line, a little bit darker, is adding in the parent-child similarity feature. And the dark gray line is when we add both. And we get the the best result when we add in both of those features. But in fact, they're both extremely simple features, and look at the huge impact that they had on performance. So it's not that something complicated or sophisticated has to be done, but that some understanding of what it is that you want to get at with your coding needs to go into thinking about what's the evidence that you have to provide to the machine learner to make it work. And you can see that depending upon the nature of the codes, what's needed is different. So, for example, in the case of macro argumentation, we also get an advantage to adding in the thread depth feature. We don't get as much of an advantage from the parent-child similarity, and we don't really get an advantage from combining those. So really just adding the one feature gives us as much impact as we can get, and the difference between the very simple feature space and that, you know, additional feature is actually really small. It's not nearly as much of an impact as we saw with the social modes of code construction. And the reason is because macro level argumentation is just a very differently natured kind of a thing, where its distribution doesn't really depend upon where in the thread that it appears, and is not really so much dependent upon how that a piece of text relates or reflects what somebody else has already said. And so again, the take-home message here is this: it's just really important to understand your data and to know what it is that you want the algorithms to pick up on. So now moving on to slide number 7, this is just an image that I always like to leave my machine learning class with on the first day, where I talk to them about these little candies. I assume that in various parts of the world, these candies also exist. They're called M&Ms. They're very popular here in the US, and kids like to divide them into piles according to color. But in order to be able to do that, it's really very simple. But if you bleach the candy white, it would become an impossible task. You wouldn't be able to separate them into their colors. And I like to tell people that if you don't think about what features you have to put into your representation or apply machine learning, it's like bleaching your candy white before you try to divide it into your colored piles. So you have to preserve the color. You have to decide what is it about the data that I have to preserve in my representation so that the machine learning will work. So now I would just like to bring up the next slide, slide number 8, which has some discussion questions on it. I think that you all have a copy of them there. For anybody who does not, I will now copy them into the chat so that you will see them. And I'm told that what I should do is give you some time to go and talk amongst yourselves and then come back with your answers to these discussion questions, and then we'll have some discussion. So that's an excellent question, and I get asked that question very frequently. Well, automated essay scoring is based really on the same technology that I used for analyzing conversations. Of course, the nature of the data is different. It's text data still, but it's essays, so it's larger blocks of text. And usually what we want to know about those blocks of text is different. Sometimes we want to know whether the ideas that somebody has communicated are correct or not, or represent a particular mental model. And other times we're interested in whether the writing was good writing or persuasive writing. The field of automated essay scoring started in the 60s, the very early 60s, and used very rudimentary modeling technology that's not altogether different from the machine learning techniques discussed in the paper that was reading for today. Essentially, the only difference is that the SVM models that we used in the paper are better at dealing with very large feature spaces and not overfitting to specific characteristics of a data set. But beyond that, they're similarly weight-based models to any kind of regression model, which was more typical in automated essay scoring in the early days. Now, actually, interestingly, if you look at the results of how effective automated essay scoring technology was in the early days and today, you really won't see any noticeable difference. It hasn't really advanced. What has changed is the set of features that people tend to use for doing the for training the models. Because what happened was, despite the fact that the early models got very high accuracy in relationship to hand-coded data, teachers didn't trust them because they relied on features like how many words long was the essay, how many big words were included, how much punctuation was there. And those were good correlates. They correlated with the things that you would really want to see in a persuasive essay, like sophistication of argumentation, or that somebody had something substantive to say, or that their vocabulary was sophisticated. And obviously these proxies could be gamed, they could be confused, they would make errors sometimes, but there are also errors or disagreements among humans, and so the correlation between the automated scoring and the hand scoring was as high, about as high as you would get agreement between humans. Although, importantly, and this applies equally to the kind of analysis that I do, the kinds of mistakes that the automated system would make are often different than the kinds of disagreements that humans have with one another. And I think that's an important thing to consider when using a technique like this. So on that front, I would say that that the two areas are really very, very similar. In fact, some of my students have gone on to work on automated essay scoring, and Lightside is now a spin-off company, although the tool bench is still free. There's add-on software that they're developing for commercial purposes for doing essay scoring. But beyond those kind of like high-level process issues, when it comes to actually getting into the data and thinking about, okay, what would be meaningful features, what would be features that teachers would trust, what would be features that, meaningfully correlate with essay quality, in my own research, I'm less interested in those aspects of language and just more interested in how interaction works. And those, so from my standpoint, when it comes to actually doing the work and when it comes to spending time digging into transcripts and looking at the data and thinking about what kind of features would help us to get at important constructs that represent what makes a good interaction, I'm just much more interested substantively in that. So the technology is not so different, but I think that the meat of the work is really different. It's what I spend my time thinking about most of the time is different than what I would be thinking about if I was doing essay scoring. Okay, the question about how much data do you have to label? I also always get that question very early in the semester whenever I teach machine learning, and it really depends on how complex the labeling scheme is and how subtle it is. So, sometimes it's very straightforward to identify categories of text, and there's a lot of homogeneity within texts that are labeled similarly, and because of that, you can get away with very few examples, and I would say minimum, you should code 10 examples of each category that you want to learn a model for, but that will only work for a very, very simple, very direct mapping. For lots more complex codes, then you would need probably about 1,000 coded instances, not per category, but overall. So when I teach my class, again, I tell the students in my class, they all do a project. I try to get everyone to have at least 1,000 coded examples to work with throughout the semester so that they have enough to go on. And that's a good rule of thumb. For essay scoring, we have found that, on average, I found, at least when I've looked at data that has been provided to me, that say 20 examples per sort of level, like if you were grading on kind of a numeric scale, a 5-point numeric scale, you would want to have like 20 of each, so that's like 100 coded examples. That seemed to work really well, but again, it depends exactly on how subtle the distinctions are, what exactly is the nature of the rubric that you're applying to your particular data. So it's impossible to give a cut and dried answer to that question, as much as everyone would love to have a cut and dried answer. Uh, Okay, so how does machine learning compare with epistemic network analysis? So let me ask you a follow-up question. By epistemic network analysis, is that a form of social network analysis? I actually am not so familiar with the term itself. The person who asked that question, it looks like it was David. Can you please? Okay, while I'm waiting for the answer on epistemic and network analysis, I'll try to answer some of these other questions. So how heterogeneous can the raw material be? Actually, if you go back and you look at the article that you read for today, you'll see that that very issue discussed. There was an issue where in one of the very difficult dimensions to be able to reliably replicate the human coding. The problem was that the majority class category was very hard to define. It was sort of an anything else category. And it's very, very hard to for a machine learning model to develop a set of features that represent that category. And so what sometimes ends up happening is that, well, and also maybe the minority class categories are easy to define, but you don't have very many examples of them. So then what ends up happening is that the model is not able to find a way of separating those the smaller categories from that larger category, because that larger category is ill-defined. Now, there's a difference between ill-defined, like, you know, it can be anything other than these things that are well-defined, or it can just be very diverse, so there can be just lots of creative ways that somebody might express a particular idea. If it's the second, then you can compensate for that heterogeneity with more data, but you just have to have enough data so that you can build a model of the kinds of things that are associated with all of the different ways that a category can be represented. But if you're in the case where it's just wide open, that there isn't a way of defining it, that it's defined as not something else. Like, you can be off topic in any of a number of ways, but you can only be on topic in a finite number of ways. So it's much easier to define what it means to be on topic, and if you define off topic as everything else, it's just not well defined. So so you should decide what side you're on. Are you on the side of heterogeneity, in which case you just need more data, or are you on the side of ill-defined, in which case it's just going to be really hard to build a model to find that. Now, what you can do is try to use a kind of model that has a default class, in which case if you can at least build a reliable model of all of your other categories, then everything else just gets sent to this sort of ill-defined category, and so that can be a way of working around it. But again, when it comes to these kinds of issues, it's very specific to your particular data set and category scheme, and this is where it's really helpful to sit down with somebody who has experience working with this kind of technology, who can help you to say, oh, okay, it looks like you're having this problem, let's try X, Y, and Z, okay, you know, here might be a solution. And over time you sort of develop these intuitions, and it comes with experience. And it's the kind of thing that you don't really learn from one little session like this, but I'm sure that you can find experts at your university, or, you know, feel free to email me to set up a Skype meeting where we can sit down and look at your particular data and talk you through it. Let me see what other kinds of questions people have left. Let's see. Okay, somebody asked me about automatically coding Chinese data. Actually, in Taiwan, There is a national research lab called Academia Sinica, and at Academia Sinica there is a group that works on Chinese natural language processing, and they have a set of tools that can be used to segment Chinese into tokens, and once you have done that, then you can apply text mining tools just the same as with English or any other language. That can be sort of plugged in as a plug-in into something like Tag Helper or Lightside. We actually used to have a Chinese version of Tag Helper, and actually so there's a Wang et al. 2011 IJCSDL article where we talked about an idea generation task, and we used Tag Helper, the Chinese version of Tag Helper, to classify student ideas into 18 particular idea categories, so that would be an example of doing text classification on Chinese. So for anyone who's interested in doing that, contact me and I can help you out with that. You would have to get a license from Academia segmentation tool, but then you would be able to use something like Lightside to do the next steps. Let's see. Okay, so somebody was talking about autocoding software, and that their impression is that it tends to be driven more by things like connections between pronoun usage and identity. And actually, yes, you can find quite a lot of work like that. And again, in the article that you read for today, there was a comparison between using machine learning to build models of for automated coding and something called linguistic inquiry and word count, which is it comes from James Pennebaker's group. Some of you, especially social psychologists, might be familiar with his work. And his tool is actually very widely used in the area of social psychology, where they in studies where they gather conversational data or even sometimes monologues. And so here's what's different. LIWC was developed through collecting a huge corpus of natural language data and questionnaire data, and then applying a factor analysis and finding scales within patterns of words that could be used to match texts to particular, say, personality profiles. And so from that, they constructed these word lists where they assign kind of a numerical value to the occurrence of a word for a particular scale, so that if you have a text, you can get a rating along a very large number of scales that they have constructed from data from earlier studies. And so then, they have things like, high confidence words or high affect words or positive affect versus negative affect versus, cognitive mechanism shows that, you should be thinking in a sophisticated kind of a way. And so then these scales are used to make estimates of, what the formulation of a particular text says about the kind of person who's talking. Now, personally, what bothers me about that kind of work is that there isn't sufficient consideration given to the very many different factors that affect the distribution of words that show up in the texts that, represent what people say. If you completely control so that all of the texts that you're applying it to were collected under the same circumstances, then you control for many of those factors, and so then you could get a more valid indication from differences in how those scales are represented across people or across conditions of what's going on. But sometimes people will apply them in places where it wouldn't be valid to do so. And sometimes those word scales themselves are just not appropriate. So for example, there's an example I gave in the article where we had a set of tutoring dialogues, and some of the tutors were much more effective than other tutors. And this was in a calculus tutoring context, and what it showed was that the tutors that rated higher on confidence, according to LIWC, were more effective tutors. But what it turned out when we went back and we looked at which words it was picking out, the more effective tutors were ones that talked about algebra more. And so the word factor came up, and it was picking up on the word factor and attributing confidence to that word when, in fact, in context, that's not at all what it meant. Now, machine learning can also be it can also be misled, but I would say that what happens normally when you use a machine learning kind of methodology for doing your automated coding is that you just have a methodology where you're building models for the particular data that you're working on. And I think that you're much less likely to make an invalid inference from the text when your model is specific to the kind of data that you're collecting instead of being based on loads of previously collected data when who knows, you know, under what circumstances all that data was collected and if those circumstances are in any way similar to the study setup that you have. So that's what I would say about that. Let me look back here. Okay, now I see what epistemic network analysis, it's about networks of words. Okay, yes, and so for example, I know that Kathleen Carley here at CMU does a lot of analysis of text where she looks at the relationships between words. That doesn't happen standardly with the most of the supervised machine learning techniques that are applied in and that are used frequently in a tool like TagHelper or LightSide. However, there are other tools like latent Dirichlet allocation, which is a form of topic modeling that is used as a kind of dimensionality reduction and is frequently used paired with some of those models. So for example, you might take something like latent Dirichlet allocation and apply it to your word vectors, so just the raw text that that's in your data, and then that will re-represent your features in terms of these topics. And the topics are, like I said, dimensions. And in some ways, if you look at how that algorithm is working, it's representing text kind of as a network. Texts that occur together are ones that are connected. If they occur together frequently, the connection between them is stronger. And so then you leverage those connections between words in identifying those factors. From that standpoint, then these machine learning models can be related to that kind of epistemic network analysis. But I would say that they're doing different things. But I guess from my understanding, just from what I'm seeing here and what I have looked into, although that's not my particular area of expertise, I would say I would view it more as a dimensionality kind of reduction. So there are techniques like matrix factorization also that sort of simultaneously cluster your text and also get you down to a kind of reduced dimensionality. And again, they're leveraging similar interconnectivity patterns between words and texts. And that can be useful for, especially if you want to get down to kind of a more reduced representation of your text. So I think a lot more could be said about it if I had a more specific question. So then I'll leave it to you to ask more questions. I think that if we want to get on to the rest of the presentation, we should move on. But actually, it's more important to me to make sure that you all have the chance to discuss what's meaningful to you. So let's have a vote. How many people vote for continuing to discuss these issues versus how many people vote for moving on? So first, let's take, you can go to the vote panel. How many people vote for continuing?
Well, I had a really quick question with regard to the discussion questions on your slide. And I'm generally sold on the idea of automated analysis. And I use it primarily in gameplay telemetry data analysis, and I've dabbled a little bit in textual analysis. And the thing I wanted to ask about was what you touched on at the end of the paper we read, which is the problems with automated segmentation. And I'm sort of curious about how you're dealing with that now, because I think it's something that comes up in a lot of these different fields where we're trying to deal with automated analysis of complex.
So segmentation is indeed an issue. I get around it in a lot of the work that I do working with chat logs because you can just take a contribution as a segment, and that works pretty well in most cases. I know that Jinmu did some work on improving on the segmentation problem that was discussed at the end of the paper that you all read. One of the issues with that segmentation was that there wasn't kind of a structural definition of what counted as a segment. It was more about how much text would it take to get a label on one of the particular dimensions in the coding scheme. And so because it was content-based and not structural, it would be really difficult with, say, a sequence tool like what we talked about in that last part of the paper to reliably find those segment boundaries. I believe that what ended up happening after that work was that the notion of a segment was kind of redefined in future work. But I think it still turned out to be problematic. And it's true that, and Karsten could actually tell you more about the experience that they had working with the segmentation, because in their context, it was more important to be able to identify those segments. So in work that I've done where we were working with larger chunks of text than you get in a single contribution in a chat environment, what we did was we trained the models to eliminate eliminate unimportant parts of the text when honing in on just those parts that were relevant for a particular kind of coding that we were doing. So in particular, we were working on data from, it was again an online chat, but it was one where people would go on and on and on and on. This was a medical support context, and people told a lot of stories, and so their contributions were long. And also, our unit of analysis was, say, everything a person might have said in a particular thread within that discussion. So it wasn't even one turn. But then we would have to narrow down to the part of what they said that was relevant for the coding that we were doing. And so as we were learning our codes, we simultaneously learned to narrow down to that part of the text that was relevant. Now, this paper was published last summer at the Association for Computational Linguistics, and I'd be happy to pass on that paper if anybody is interested. Maybe I'll just quickly find the reference for that, and I can just paste it into the text, and you can just go ahead and download that paper from the web. Okay, I am looking very quickly to find it on my computer. And here it is. Okay, so you should be able to find that online. So it looks like we're about 50-50 split between let's keep talking about these things versus move on. Oh, sorry. And move on to the next segment. After the first segment of my talk, there were three different segments, and it's looking to me from looking at my calendar, my clock, that we're not going to be able to get through all of them. So what I'm going to just do is go through the first one, which is sort of an example, and sort of refer to what's in the other segments, and then you can kind of browse through, and then as we discuss it, then you can draw my attention to aspects of the other segments I didn't get to that you might be curious about. These next three parts of my talk are related to my contribution in the International Handbook of Collaborative Learning, and I believe that the reference to that chapter was in the related or like supplementary readings that were publicized to you guys. If not, I think you can probably find it in that book if you have it. So let's look at slide number 10. So here I refer to that chapter from that book, and I refer to three different dimensions of a coding scheme that my group has developed and that we have been examining in connection with mostly chat conversations in a collaborative learning context. And here we have in the middle of that representation, you can see there's two people, and that's just sort of like a representation of dyadic interaction, maybe within a group where there are actually more than two people. But the heart of what we want to get at is very similar to the social modes of co-construction, but we call it transactive knowledge integration. And basically what we're trying to do is separate contributions into ones that express reasoning versus ones that don't make reasoning public. And among the ones that make reasoning public, how many of them are transactive in some way? So they build on some previously articulated piece of reasoning from the conversation. And we want to see that our support for collaboration increases the extent to which people display reasoning and build on each other's reasoning. And then you can see around the side that we have two other dimensions. There's the horizontal positioning dimension, which we call engagement, and a vertical positioning dimension called authority. And the idea is that in order to encourage transactive knowledge integration, you have to bring the students within a group into a close proximity with one another, both in terms of their horizontal positioning, so that they're showing openness and welcoming of each other's ideas, and also on the vertical dimension, where they're positioning each other and themselves as having something valuable to say. If those are out of balance, if it's treated as though only one person has something valuable to offer, the other student is not going to be also contributing their own reasoning and building, because they'll just be accepting what the other person is saying. So then it becomes kind of a one-way communication. So we want on the vertical dimension to see some balance so that we have an exchange. And so even though we don't expect to see a direct relationship between the social positioning aspects and cognitive aspects of learning, we see those as playing a supporting role in bringing the students into a close enough social connection so that we get the kind of exchange that we want to see. Now, in these three segments that are in my talk, I was going to talk about each one of those dimensions in turn, and I was going to talk about results on automating the analysis, and also results of what we've seen in terms of connections with learning and other constructs. So if you move forward, you'll see that I'm starting with the transactive knowledge integration dimension. And if you go to slide 13, you'll see an example, a very simple example, from one of our power plant design tasks where students are studying thermodynamics. These are second year mechanical engineering students, and they're talking about principles for designing power plants and trying to balance wanting high power output with wanting to maintain environmental friendliness. And you can see them building on each other's ideas in this particular example. And then if you go forward to slide 14, you can see that what we find in our studies is that as operationalized this simple way does have a moderating effect on learning. And also in a knowledge sharing, more work-oriented task, we saw that it had a moderating effect on knowledge sharing of expertise, so where different techniques were known by different people within a group, how was the expertise passed on in a way that would optimize, functioning on an assembly line. So that was a non-learning task, but where teaching was actually relevant. And there we also see transactivity having an effect. So underneath that result, about how the construct of transactivity shows that it's valuable, we also see that we've had some success at automating it. And you can see here listed first the result that we talked about in the last segment, that was on threaded discussions, but we've looked at this in transcriptions of whole class discussions, and we've also tried to detect this in speech. Now I want to highlight the speech result, because here we actually did not base our model at all on what people were saying. And so then we couldn't do an analysis that was similar to what we had done in the data that we got from Frank, where we looked at, say, word overlap between a turn and some previously contributed turn. We had to look for other signals in the speech that that would show that transactive knowledge integration was going on. And in fact, there, what we did was we went back to this idea, that the idea of the social positioning and how that makes it more likely that a transactive exchange will take place. And so we went to the sociolinguistics literature to see what would you see and how people were communicating in the speech signal that would indicate that you had the kind of equality or balance on a social level between people that would lead to transactive knowledge integration. And we were led to the literature on speech style accommodation, and so then we worked on a computational model for measuring speech style accommodation. That doesn't require us to know what people have said, so we don't have to be able to automatically get a transcription of the conversation. We can just look at how people are pronouncing their words and how that relates to how other people in the group are pronouncing their words. And I should say, in this particular study, it was just about really dyads, not even groups. So that's a little bit simpler. But we were able to get some signal on how much transactivity was happening within these interactions just based on an automated measure of speech style accommodation. And I think that beyond just being an indication that we can automatically process transactivity, it's a validation of this model that transactivity doesn't stand on its own at a cognitive level, but that it's a reflection of a social relationship between people, and that if you look for evidence of that social relationship, it should point you to those places where you expect to see more of this transactive exchange. So even if you don't understand what's being talked about, you can see, was this a conducive environment to transactivity happening? Now, if you move on to slide 15, you can see an example coded transcript. If you want to see a chat log where we've marked places where we see reasoning and places where we see reasoning that we would count as transactive, if you want to refer to that in thinking about what questions you might have, you can feel free. And I know I'm going kind of fast, so feel free to say, whoa, that was just really too fast. But I want to give a chance for some discussion. So the discussion questions are on slide 16. So I'm just going to put in my suggested discussion questions, and you can feel free to ask for clarifications, to say, please go back to slide blah, 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 or to come in with your answer to any of these discussion questions, that is. Sam, could you please make more explicit the connection that you're trying to make there between ZPD and situation definition? I wasn't sure I quite got what you were. So actually, that's really interesting, the point that Sam raises, because there was some earlier work on transactivity that was comparing between friends and strangers. And the idea was that friends were able better to anticipate what their friend would need in order to understand something. And so then they found that there was more transactivity because people kind of knew where each other was coming from, and so they were already kind of on the same page. They had a foundation to build on in their knowledge building, and so I see what's coming up to be related to that. So that's good thinking, and Karsten is saying that he would assume gesture and gaze would be correlated because a sociocognitive conflict may be recognized in the facial expression. So I think it's true. I think that there could be two things going on there, right? So one is a very direct interpretation of what Karsten is saying, that you might notice that somebody looks confused because they noticed something that that they don't think sounds right. But I'd like to ask you, Karsten, do you think you would notice something about relative positioning between people from their gaze that might also indicate something about transactivity?
It's maybe a little bit different. Maybe the emotion is in a time series a little bit before the transactivity that can be seen in the discourse. So maybe something like confusion or surprise that can be seen during I'm listening to my learning partner then leads to a transactive behavior in the discourse, so that people then ask, what did you mean? What can you explain to me? Or they start to integrate it, or they start to create counter arguments. So it's not at the very same time, but it's in a time series, so that you might have to include time series data in your predictions. Another question that I may have, how that could be support the analysis, the automatic analysis of discourse data, if you include not only just the segment at one time, but the segments that were previous to that something before.
Right. So actually, so what Karsten is pointing out is really strongly related to the speech result that I just briefly discussed. Because in our model of speech style accommodation, what we really looked at was the pattern of pronunciation over time and how the two speakers were either converging to sound more similar to each other over time, or whether they were not moving in their pronunciation or maybe even diverging. And so, since the model was really looking over time at what do we see as this pattern that's happening in this interaction, we believed that pattern over time said more about how those students were positioned related to each other than anything that you could just pick out of one particular segment. And then once you saw the trend over time that told you, were they listening to each other? Were they open to each other's ideas? Then using that as an indicator, you would be able to at least predict sort of prevalence, not where in the interaction the transactivity occurred. That turned out to be almost impossible to do from speech, or at least we weren't successful in being able to pinpoint the places in the conversation where the transactivity occurred. But what we were able to do was to predict the prevalence of transactivity. So the pattern over time and how you could view the social climate between people based on how their pronunciation was shifting to become more like each other or more just different or just not shifting over time said something about whether we were going to see a lot or a little bit of transactivity. So I think that there are lots of things that can be going on. Emotions can be going on, confusion can be going on. There can be particular events that happen in a conversation about how an idea is presented, particularly persuasively, that might capture somebody's attention and lead to a transactive contribution coming next. What's important, I think, is to build into your model the ability to track those aspects that you think would be indicative And again, you can see, I'm not really talking a lot about the structure of the models or which algorithms. What I'm talking about is what is the information that you provide. And you can see from this discussion that what we're drawing from is really our understanding of educational psychology, social psychology. We're drawing in our understanding of people, and we're using that to motivate how we're designing these representations. So what we really need to know is just to understand the phenomenon very deeply. That helps us to be able to do the modeling, and that's more important than the technology itself or the algorithms themselves. And so because of that, I think it's important to note that as learning science researchers, you don't have to feel that you're such at a disadvantage for not having a deep theoretical understanding of machine learning algorithms, because you probably don't need very much of a deep understanding. Having some conceptual understanding of what the algorithms are doing will help you to know how what you're providing will be used by those algorithms, but really it's your understanding of your data that's most important, and that's the message I really want to contribute. I really want to get across in this discussion. Okay, so Jin has a question. What is the contribution of the content analysis on transactivity compared with social network analysis? Now, we have not looked at how social network analysis predicts transactivity, but I would bet that people who have a high out degree would contribute more transactive contributions. But that might just mean people who, I think what you would want to know is, that's a really good question. It's a really good question how transactivity would be represented in a network structure. There is a lot of work on trying to bring text analysis and network analysis together, and I haven't seen any formal analysis of the connection. I think it would be really interesting to do. Actually, if you want to run that experiment, we'd be happy to help you. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer right now. Questions? Things that people want to ask? Okay, I'm afraid I lost you all because that middle segment kind of went by fast, but now it seems to me, based on the time, we have about 15 more minutes left, and there was supposed to be kind of an interview at the end. So I want to just jump forward to give you a couple of slides from the last part of my talk. So if you zoom to slide 29, that's where I start to give a little bit of a tour of the LightSide tool. If you look at slide 30, you can see, if you look at the top of that screenshot, the URL where you can download it. And I encourage anybody who would like to play with it to just go ahead and download it off the web. And it has some example data sets that you can play with included. Slide 31 shows you the interface where you can load the data and to extract features. And there you can see, under Configure Basic Features, all the features listed. You could just check off boxes and really replicate exactly the baseline experiment from that paper you read for today, for example. And once you have extracted features, moving on to slide 32, you can see the screen where you can actually run a machine learning experiment. There are some algorithms that you can pick from at the top. And then you can see on slide 33 an interface that allows you to kind of troubleshoot your model to see what are the examples it's making mistakes on and what explanation can I find for those mistakes. Now, of course, in just the few sentences I said, you won't know exactly how to use the tool, but it comes with a user's manual. So when you download it, you'll see the user's manual in there, and it has some tutorials to lead you through. And hopefully you would be able to figure out from the tutorial how to use it. And again, if you have questions, you can just contact me, and I can set up a meeting with you directly or between you and one of my grad students to help you learn how to use it. Somebody asked, is there already a German version of LightSide? No, not at the moment, but it would be easy to put one together. So we had a German part of Speech Tagger and Morphological Analyzer that was part of Tag Helper. So we had a German version of Tag Helper, and it would be almost trivial to link those up to LightSide. So usually the best thing to do is send me an email, and I forward it on to one of my graduate students, and they can probably get that together for you pretty quick. So we just got a Hebrew version of LightSide working very recently, and that was pretty similar. And so as for a Chinese LightSide, like I said, in order to be able to do Chinese processing, we need access to the segmenter that you can get from Academia Sinica. I can't give away a license to that. You have to contact them directly. But once you have permission to use their segmenter, then we can link that up to LightSide. So we had a Chinese version of Tag Helper, as I mentioned. And so again, it would be simple to hook that up to LightSide. So in general, both Tag Helper and LightSide were, set up with a plug-in architecture that would make it easy to be able to use the same pipeline and tools that are available in LightSide, but with different languages, just by building different, like a wrapper around a different part of Speech Tagger or a different morphological analyzer. And so that makes it easy to, because there's a separation between that layer of processing and the other kinds of things that LightSide does. Okay, so somebody says, what are the relationships among transactivity, engagement, and authoritativeness? So if you look at the slides where I've summarized the results, you can see that in our prior work we have found that conversations where there's a higher level of what we measure as engagement, which is showing openness, we also see more reasoning communicated, which makes sense. We've seen this in correlational analyses, and we have also done some experimental studies where we manipulated, say, the style of a conversational agent to show more openness or to show less openness, to see how that affected how much students were willing to be open about their ideas. And we see that students are more open about their ideas when the instructions that the agent gives are framed in a way that shows more openness. Hang on one second. Let's see. So what we haven't found is a reliable connection between authority, engagement, and transactivity. And we think it's because actually in our chat logs, transactivity is pretty rare. We have seen that people who take a more authoritative stance display more reasoning, even though the turns that are marked as being a source in a conversation or being more open aren't necessarily ones that display reasoning, but we do see that correlation. So that's just kind of a summary. You can flip through those slides to see some more relationships. I actually just wrote a paper that I submitted to a workshop that talks more about the relationships that we have found between these constructs, and I'd be really happy to pass that draft on. So if anybody wants it, just send me email and I'll mail you the draft. I'll be happy, and also happy to hear any feedback that you might have on the ideas that are communicated there. Let's see here. Does LightSide also help with segmentation? So there isn't a segmenting tool built into LightSide at this point. So I guess the simple answer is no. I know that Jinmu has worked on the segmentation most recently, so I would just refer to her. Let's see. Now, how can trained models be implemented in software like Moodle? One of my graduate students has done some work with Moodle, and Moodle is really just, it's there's a threaded discussion inside of Moodle. It connects up to a database. It's possible to insert a layer of processing in between the interface that students see and that database so that it's possible to be able to monitor those turns that students are contributing and applying labels which allow you to keep a student model of how that student is participating in the discussion and even to trigger support in the context of that threaded discussion. And so if you're interested in being able to do something like that, again, I would put you in touch with one of my graduate students who has already been doing some work along those lines. So Vincent Alevin, one of my colleagues here, was teaching a class where students were doing projects where they were modifying Moodle, and my graduate students, both the student who was the first developer of Lightside and also a student who develops conversational agents, taught units of that class and worked with students to see how those things could be integrated with Moodle. So I know that they would be able to help people who are specifically interested in that. So since we are down to the last few minutes here, I believe that there was supposed to be a segment at the end where there were some interview questions from Karsten and company. I know it was going to be Frank, and he wasn't able to join us today. Do we want to go ahead and move into that segment? Should I go ahead and stop broadcasting, Karsten, so that you can take that interviewer?
Thank you very much, Carolyn. Yes, there's a short interview session planned. Don't expect too much. I will not interrogate you too harsh. Maybe just small things. The automatic segmentation stuff, we already did that in our first work, and Jin proceeded with that. We reframed the segmentation problem into a coding problem where the question was just be, is there a border between two segments, two words? And so the segmentation problem was reframed to a coding problem so that it was could be solved. But the important thing here is some questions for Carolyn. And my important question that I was told that I had to ask it is, Carolyn, what is your advice to all these upcoming new learning scientists? What from your work, what are the hints against the background of your work for them in their future research?
Well, I do think that the area of automated discourse analysis is one that's going to be getting more and more attention, especially as there's so much research now on MOOCs, and so then there's so much more large-scale interaction data, and that people want to be able to get their heads around what's happening in those contexts and also to give some clues to instructors of those courses where they might most fruitfully intervene. And I think one of the things that we have learned from our work is that keeping it simple is really a good thing to do, and to think about, well, what is it at minimum that you need to be able to take away from what students have contributed in order to be able to provide the ESA instructor with some insight into who they should be talking to or which messages they should be participating in. Sometimes you have to scale back your expectations, and once you start to think in terms of what would be required, once you think, you know, along the lines of some of the things that we were talking through in this session, what would be required in order to be able to pick this up reliably from what people are saying, then you can kind of strategize about you know, whether it's going to be worth the effort. And knowing that not every coding task is equally hard or would require as much upfront effort on your part, so you always have to think, what am I putting in? What am I going to get back? How specific is this coding task to this one study versus usable over a longer term in some things that I plan to do. And so my encouragement would be to say to yourself, you know, this technology, it's not going away. It's going to become more ubiquitous, but we need to be smart about how we use it. We need to know, we're not be naive about what's going to be involved. And we need to collaborate with the right people so that, you know, we can bring together the substantial insight that you all have into the psychology and the pedagogy of what it is that you're trying to do. But, you know, don't leave out your colleagues on the other side of campus who might also be able to help you on a technical side. I would love to see more active collaborations going. I loved the work that I did with Frank and Karsten and Armin, and I think it's a good example for our community, and I'd like to see more of that happen.
Thank you for that great answer. Maybe one more provocative question. Is there a topic in discourse analysis or a feature of a study where you would say, no, do not apply this method, do not do this automatically? Is there a criteria where you would say, no, this is not a thing that should be done with LightSight or TechHelper?
Well, so one thing I can tell you is extremely difficult is to be able to make inferences about how correct some very complex mathematical reasoning is as expressed in some text, because it's really important in order to make that assessment to get all the details right about how all the pieces of the sentence are related to one another. And so that really just requires so sophisticated a processing that it would be really slow to build in the knowledge. Second, it would be really slow to apply to all the data. And third, it would probably be very error prone, and it would be very difficult to do that assessment. So I would say that kind of represents that, you know, something that I think would be sort of too ambitious for the state of the art right now. Another thing to think about is how messy is the data. So I would say maybe of less interest so far in the learning sciences community, but of a lot of interest in the Language Technologies Institute, community is data from Twitter, for example, because you can get huge Twitter data sets. So lots of people want to be able to analyze Twitter data. But in fact, it's very messy, and the contributions are so short that it's hard for anybody to say anything substantive anyway. It doesn't really even look very much like language because people manipulate the text so much in order to make use of that very short space that they have. And so I would say I'm not sure that it's worth all the excitement that people put into processing that kind of data, especially from our side of wanting to understand how people interact and how people learn. So I think that's kind of two different versions of the answer to that question. One is about something that might just require more sophistication than is practical, and another where the data itself just might be too removed from what it is that you really want to learn.
So now I saw a question from Namsok. I just read them aloud. I'm wondering if the analysis can be used to assess language development, particularly for second and foreign language proficiency.
Okay, Ruth Wiley, who was a student here at CMU, and she's now at Arizona State University, actually did some work using machine learning to be able to make an assessment about somebody's second language acquisition. She focused specifically on errors related to article usage, but she may have worked on other aspects of language acquisition as well, and might also be familiar with other related work. So certainly there is work in that space. I believe machine learning can be used to make such assessments. That's not my particular area, but I think that work is out there. And I would just point you to Ruth Wiley. Let me just write her name. Ruth Wiley, and that's at Arizona State University. And she's an extremely nice person, so you can just email her, and I'm sure she'd be happy to pass papers along.
And there's also a question that I struggled with when we had our first paper with automatic analysis, and Jin posed that question again. If a huge amount of features is extracted by LightSight as the first step, what is your professional suggestion to clean and restructure the data is one thing, and to and then another decision is which algorithm to choose? What, just trial and error, or is there a state-of-the-art procedure that has to be going through to come to the best solution for the model, for the building of the models?
So there are lots of things to consider here. So one thing is that in terms of algorithms, support vector machines are known for being very good at handling large feature spaces. So frequently you don't even have to do any kind of feature selection to narrow down to a smaller feature space. As long as you have a sufficient number of training examples, then it's possible for an SVM model to learn some effective weights even in the face of having very large feature sets. But there are also techniques called feature selection techniques that can take your very large set of features and narrow down to some smaller subset of ones that have the highest correlation with your class value. This needs to be applied only to your training data. You should not apply it to your testing data. So, and there are ways of making sure that you set that up properly, and I won't get into that detail right now, but if you're curious about it, I'd be happy to have a conversation with any of you offline about those methodological issues. And if you use feature selection in Tag Helper or LightSide, it will guide you to use it properly, follow the instructions in the user's manual. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that you do some kind of dimensionality reduction. And that would be similar to doing a factor analysis or a principal components analysis. You can construct some scales out of the features that you have. And so then that'll help you to reduce down also to some dimensions so that your feature space is not so large. Typically, the biggest problem with very large feature spaces is that, you know, even just extracting them all, so even before you could run some kind of dimensionality reduction or do your feature selection, you might actually run out of memory. You should make sure that you configure the tool to have the maximum amount of memory that your computer will allow, and so that the package as you download it is set up not to do that. And there's a little configuration file that you can modify, so you can tell it based on how your computer is, like what the hardware capabilities are of your computer, what would be the maximum amount of memory it can have. And if you increase it over the default, you'll find that you have fewer problems with very large feature spaces. It's also important to be very strategic about what's the set of features that you tell LightSide or Tag Helper to extract. So don't just click on everything and then extract all those features, but have a reason. So start with the really simple feature space, then do an error analysis and find out where that feature space is weak, and then use that to motivate your decision for what additional kinds of features you want to add in. If you're strategic about which kinds of features you add in, then you'll have fewer problems with having too big of a feature space. So hopefully those are a few rules of thumb that will help. And again, if you run into problems, please contact me. Maybe I can point you to a course you might take or online or give you some additional tips, because this, you know, little discussion we're having really is just the tip of an iceberg.
Okay, thank you very much for all your advice and your help and your very interesting talk. It seems that most of us have get answered all their questions. So now it's up to me to say you a big, big thank you for your talk and your invitation to bother you with all our questions around automatic analysis. And I also thank everybody, all participants, for their contributions to the discussions. Wish you a good night or day. It depends where all over the world you are. And hope you see you somewhere at some conferences at the world, maybe during the next Naples meeting. Thank you very much for this great webinar as Daniel sends us.